So good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We would like to call to order our February meeting of the District of Columbia Board of Pharmacy. Today is February the 1st, 2018. We are starting off with our opening session. We will begin our meeting with having members of the board along with our staff introduce ourselves, then we'll go around and kindly ask you to introduce yourself, state your name. If you are affiliated with any organization, please state that as well. And before you leave, please remember to sign the sign-in sheet. So I'll begin. I'm Becky Lamar, board member.
Eddie Curry, consumer board member.
Good morning, Alan Friedman, board member.
Good morning, Benjamin Miles, board member.
Our staff cousin.
Good morning, Shauna White, executive director.
Good morning, Corinne Barron, health licensing specialist for the Board of Pharmacy.
Good morning, Carla Williams, board counsel.
Thank you. And so now we'll start on this end. If you don't mind, please state your name and, again, if you're affiliated with any organization.
Hi, my name is Vicki Matthew. I'm a pharmacy student at Howard University College of Pharmacy, and I'm a pharmacy student at Dr. White.
Hi, my name is
Andrew Beth, PGY1 resident with Walgreens Health System Pharmacy and Howard University College of Pharmacy.
I'm Robbie Clifton, and I'm pharmacy manager at Walmart and Fort Tyler location.
John Zawater with PC Republic.
Jennifer Thomas with Del Mar Foundation.
I am Charlene Fairfax, I'm senior pharmacist with the Department of Healthcare Finance.
Anna Reed, chief of the AIDS Drug Assistance Program with HOSTA.
Nicholas Bender, I'm a fourth year doctor of pharmacy candidate at Howard University College of Pharmacy, and I'm interning here with Dr. Reed.
Machine Dr. Body for Kaiser Permanente.
How they say for Kaiser Permanente?
Good morning, Lisa Legay with Express Scripts.
Good morning, Janu Phillip with Walgreens. I'm also chair of the Florida board.
Thank you and welcome. And so we will begin. We do have a quorum, just for the record. We have one and maybe two board members that you will see walk in a little later. So when they get here, we'll ask them to introduce themselves. And so our first item on our agenda is approval of the open session meeting minutes from December 7th, 2017. And so board members, if you've had an opportunity to review those minutes, we will entertain a motion to accept them or entertain any corrections that you might note at this time.
Good morning, Emmanuel Delgard, board member.
Thank you.
I move that we approve the minutes from December 2017.
All right, is there a second?
Second.
Yeah. Any discussion? Is there a general consensus in favor of the motion? So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And abstentions. One abstention from Mr. Freeman. The motion passes. The next item on our agenda is the Executive Director's Report.
Do we have January next year?
Oh yeah, you know, I saw that and I was thinking this is January. So we'll also entertain a motion to approve the January the 4th, 2018 minutes.
I'll move, Madam Chair, I'll move that we approve the January 4th open session minutes.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Thank you.
Second. Any discussion? General consensus in favor of the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions. The motion carries. Now the next item on the agenda is our executive director's report. Dr. White.
Good morning, everyone. Happy February. I wanted to provide some statistics. One statistic that we should all be proud of is that right now we have 2,027 pharmacists licensed in the District of Columbia. So I think that is a first. So that means that we are a growing community in the district. Currently, right now, we have 919 pharmacy technicians, 186 pharmacy technician trainees, 654 pharmacist interns. We have 1,261 pharmaceutical detailers. Of our licensed pharmacists, we have 604 that have vaccination and immunization authority. And currently, right now, we have 9 pharmacy technician training programs.
Thank you.
We're currently right now in renewal for our pharmaceutical detailers. That renewal period ends the 28th of this month. We have already sent out one notice, and we will be sending out more communication this week.
Thank you.
If you are a detailer and you need to renew, please go ahead and renew before the 28th.
Yes.
So December, we did send mailer reminders out for the renewal period. Are any detailers here?
So for the audience, you know, when for especially those wonderful students that are out there, when you think about questions that you see on either your NAFLEX or your board exams, guess where those questions come from? They come from item writers. So we have great volunteers from various sectors of the pharmacy community that put their time in and spend a lot of significant time coming up with good questions to hopefully reflect what you know about the profession. So, yeah.
Also, the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy, they're upgrading their e-profile system April the 2nd. There's a large announcement on their website, but in short, they will relaunch the system April 2nd, and all corresponding applications will be housed in a new streamlined system. So application processes for several programs will change, and the services that NAB provides for applicants for the pharmacy and College of Pharmacy will improve. And the system will have a new intuitive interface. They'll be sending out communication directly to the boards concerning that, but this
this would definitely affect our e-licensure transfer process for applicants that want to reciprocate into the district. So the more information that gets provided to us, we will definitely push out. But NABP has a large announcement on their website concerning when the systems will shut down, depending on what type of application you are applying for. And this will also have some effect on CPE monitor if you are trying to access your CPE monitor account.
Okay, that's it.
All right, so the board, we need to audit our pharmaceutical detailers and our pharmacists. So, would like to know the percentage of applicants of pharmacists and pharmaceutical retailers that the board would like to audit for continuing education. So the pharmacists will be from the last audit period, and then the pharmaceutical retailers, the board can decide to do this upcoming audit period.
Renewal.
Those two questions. In the past, what percent have we typically renewed? And second question is, does the executive director and staff have a recommendation for the board?
I think last time it was 10%. 10%.
The CPE tracking in place yet? Because I think you discussed that once that was in place, you would have a larger percentage. And I believe that you have to express the desire to do a larger percentage based on the factors from the previous project.
Right. So for NABPs, we can do a larger percentage because we will have access to CPE monitor information.
So when we...
It is almost impossible.
To hear?
They can't hear much.
Sure. Okay, yeah, so I'm sorry. We'll speak up if you can't hear. And if someone can just raise their hand if they're not able to hear further in
if
the back.
If you can't hear, we're not good. Doesn't work like.
And you see our lips moving, but you can't hear us.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, sound is a little muffled. So if you could
yeah, I think that air is on, but yeah, so yeah. Just raise your hand if you can't hear us, and we'll know to speak up. Thank you.
So, and we'll try to project. Just talk a bit louder. I have a big mouth, so I'm sure you probably don't have a problem hearing me. in terms of the
So Dr. Bernard is going to summarize what we've just been talking about concerning the audit.
So basically, it looks like we will be doing a bit of an audit. Each year we do somewhat of an audit, but in terms of finding an accurate number, that'll be a pretty good prediction of who's actually following up with providing adequate documentation with what they put on their applications. We're kind of taking their CE credit hours, to be specific. Then we're kind of taking a look at what percentage of the applications we're actually going to pull so that we can, during the audit. The audit involves individuals actually submitting their CE certificates, or you guys are probably all familiar with NABP CE CPE portal, monitor portal, where we can just go in and they kind of do most of the work for us. But it is likely that we might be auditing a higher percentage of our renewal applications at this time. Any questions about that?
Just a question. Is the increase in the percentage because you find people non-compliant, or just kind of curious why the number would go up?
Yes.
In short, yes.
And we've been from what to what?
Well, that's the discussion they're having, is what percentage was done before and what should be the percentage this time.
So my question is, we can use the CPE database, so it would be easy to see the total number of CEs, but in terms of, so we're using the CPE database, which would make it easier to do the audit since it centrally tracks all pharmacist CEs. However, my question is, because in DC, we have to have X number of hours for HIV and I believe med safety or ERAs. Can they also give us that breakdown?
Yeah, it does.
Or,
it specifies.
Okay.
It does. Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to manually go through and look for the HIV.
Right.
And sorry, and also if it's home study or lab, it breaks it down.
Into home study and lab.
The licensee can actually go on the website actually and print out almost like a PDF transcript. and it breaks it down, also gives the total of hours that they have done.
So basically, we're talking about the specific features that are in NAVP CPE monitor system.
Mm-hmm. Well, everything is in there. They do the AMA category.
No, so the that's what I'm doing. The continuing medical education, those items are not submitted to NAVP. So if someone does a AMA or a continuing medical education course, that information is not captured, or if they were to present a continuing education class, that information was not in there. Also, if it was like a federally offered continuing education, unless it was ACPE certified, it wouldn't be in there.
So in that case, if one of those individuals was audited and it looked to us like they didn't meet the requirement, we would outreach to them. They had an opportunity to provide but basically we would say, you're not meeting the standard. They would have the opportunity to then say, oh, I took a...
I would recommend we follow our usual procedure, which is that they're sent an audit letter and then they're required to submit the proof. So in this case, you can let them know, you'll take the CPE tracker document, and they know whether or not that's everything. And so if they want to submit that, then if they have some other courses that they've done, they can submit those certificates. But it won't be for us to do a review and then have to go back and say, oh, it looks like you're missing something. They will get an audit letter. They will submit what they have.
Oh, that makes it really easy.
Yeah, and that's what they've been getting. So in the audit letter, they'll just know, hey, you're being audited. Please provide your transcript. I mean, we can let them know you can provide CPE monitor information and any additional continuing education records that you might have.
And then what does the board have to do once all the documentation is sent in from that percent of people? What does the board do in terms of the audit?
For you, it's before asking the board, so they will have to come in and review the documentation that's submitted.
Okay.
And just let us, you know, as we kind of wrap this part up, is, you know, always remember, you know, when we fill out these renewal applications, it's always best to be honest. If you have not done all 40 of your credits, please be mindful of what you are affirming in that application, because if you're audited, then there likely will be some kind of penalty tied to that inaccurate information that was provided. So it's always best to get your CE hours, and if you don't have them, just be careful of what you put on that renewal application, because you just might get audited at some point. Any other questions about that?
So we need a motion.
The percentage to audit.
So I'll make a motion that the board implement an audit for continuing education, and that we audit 20%.
For a pharmacist. There's a motion that's been made and seconded. That motion is for an audit of 20% of pharmacist renewal application. Any discussion? Yes.
And it's currently
10%,
correct?
One second. So discussion. I'll open up discussion.
I'm sorry, it's currently 10%, correct?
Previously, we've done about 10% in terms of exactly what that number was for the most recent one. I think we're checking to confirm that, but in the past, it has been about
10%. Okay. Just had a question. Is this for the 2019?
Nope. 2017.
So they would be renewing, they would have renewed in 2017 last year.
Right.
Any other questions? Is there general consensus in favor of the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? The motion carries. Okay, so a second motion in regards to the audit percentage for pharmaceutical detailers.
There's the, we address it after we got there. So we'll pick this up.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. So we'll do a motion on the detailers at our next meeting, or at April meeting.
Technicians, when do we?
They won't be required to have CEs until 2019.
Okay, thanks.
So the question was about the technicians. So technicians will be renewing in 2019, and at that time we will determine what percentage of those renewal applications we will audit as well.
We don't have anybody renewing.
Okay.
I think we just want to tell everyone.
We had a small number of people that are still renewing.
With the detailers, the 2016 renewal.
I have not had it.
But you have the 2018 renewal.
They've already renewed the first time. So they were the grass farm. They just a lot of become a technician. Right, but he has a grandfather.
That didn't make sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
They got the 2019.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So the next item on our agenda is our Assistant General Counsel's report. So Carla.
So at the December meeting, I informed everyone of a couple of pieces of legislation at the council that affect pharmacy practice. The first one being the Defending Access to Women's Healthcare Services Amendment Act. And that's one that would allow pharmacists to prescribe and dispense certain contraceptives. That particular piece of legislation has moved forward. It's now pending with the mayor. The mayor's response is due by tomorrow. So once it comes back to the council from the mayor, then it will go to Congress for their review, and then it will become law. So that one should be in place probably by the time of our next public meeting with April. The second piece is the Opioid Abuse Prevention Amendment Act. That's the bill that's looking to put limits on the day supply that prescribers can give for opioids. There is a hearing coming up before the council on Monday, February 12th. If anyone wants to submit testimony or to actually testify, you can provide that directly to the council as to how you feel about that particular piece of legislation. And we'll keep you updated as to how that moves forward. Any questions? That concludes my report.
Thank you. And so at any time, our Senior Deputy Director, Dr. Lewis, will likely come in and bring greetings. And so when she does, I will stop the meeting and give her an opportunity to do that. And so at this time, the next item is our Legislative and Regulatory Subcommittee report. So, Mr. Friedman.
Good morning, everybody. So, two items. First of all, as I think everybody knows, a bill passed some time back which would allow pharmacists to prescribe and dispense naloxone. One of the requirements, however, was for a training program to be developed, which all pharmacists now licensed in the District of Columbia would have to undertake and attest to, and then once they passed, they could participate. I received an email this morning from GW, who we're partnering with. So for everybody here, that if anyone doesn't know, the board worked with Dr. Lindsay Beckman, who is a pharmacy quality and safety chief at Kaiser Permanente, to develop a training program. And Dr. Miles and myself attended the training over at GW. They coordinate the training for, what's it called? Centers for Rational Prescribing, with the intent to provide that training to DC licensed pharmacists along with the appropriate CE. It was 1 hour CE. Dr. Beckman recorded the content. Dr. Bernard recorded a terrific introduction. And we were waiting for the final edits and then that to be published. So the email that I got this morning, I asked about when that would be ready to be posted, was that the release has been delayed. There may be a change in the DC law that allows pharmacists to prescribe and dispense naloxone. We're waiting to hear about the next steps, what the next steps are for that module. So I wasn't sure. And I just found out this morning, or I would have touched base with you earlier, do we have any updated information on
right,
that?
Right, so right now, we don't have any particular updated information that we can share at this time, but hopefully we will be finding something soon as far as like if any changes, or if we can just go ahead and proceed with what we have.
Okay.
So we will let you know as soon as we know some information.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Able to share.
Okay. Thank you. Second topic is collaborative practice. So just to refresh, quite some time ago, a law was passed, or a bill was passed that became law in the District of Columbia that would allow pharmacists to work with prescribers to under a collaborative practice arrangement. And it required the Board of Pharmacy to work with the Board of Medicine, or actually any of the agencies for those prescribers, and develop regulations jointly. So the board decided at the time to start with the Board of Medicine and work with them. Is it Board of Medicine or Board of Physicians? Board of Medicine, thank you. To work with them to promulgate those regulations. Keeping in mind that the law would allow other prescribers potentially to also work with pharmacists under a collaborative arrangement. But the Board of Pharmacy decided that they didn't want it to be too complex by trying to work with too many agencies at the same time, and if we could establish regulations for physicians and pharmacists, and assuming that they were successful, we could then outreach to other agencies as well. So we've been working on this for a very long period of time, and regulations were published. We received comments from the public. The board held a special hearing with stakeholders in the institutional setting because since they would be impacted as well, we were interested in their perspective. The board made substantial changes to the draft regulations to include a section on institutions, and we defined what institutions were. And the regulations were subsequently published again in the District of Columbia Register for further comment. I will let you know that 30 comments were received by interested parties. The Legislative and Regulatory Committee got together and reviewed all 30 comments in detail relative to what's currently published in draft form, and in order to make a decision and a recommendation for the board moving forward. If I were to summarize the comments, I would say the majority of them were, well, all of them were in favor of collaborative practice, the philosophy of collaborative practice. The great majority of the comments were in support of the regulations as written, and basically the message was, get it done. Let's move it forward, collaborative practice. So there were some comments, and the Legislative and Regulatory Committee looked at those and debated whether additional changes should be made. So that everybody understands, if additional changes were made, it would require the Board of Pharmacy to then go back, work with the Board of Medicine to agree on any changes. So there would be those conversations in that period of time. Once the Board of Pharmacy and Board of Medicine agreed on whether changes needed to be made, if no changes were to be made, they would be published as final, and then collaborative practice could be implemented in the District of Columbia. If changes were made, they would need to be published in the DC Register again for another comment period. If comments were received, Board of Pharmacy would once again have to go through all of those, and the process would continue until no changes were made. In looking at all of the comments, it's the Legislative and Regulatory Committee's recommendation that we should move forward with the draft regulations as they were last published. In other words, we should not make changes. The committee felt that there were not changes that needed to be made in order for collaborative practice to be implemented in the District of Columbia. And the thought was that up the road, because it's easier to change regulations than a law, if interested parties, stakeholders, after a period of time and based on experience, felt that regulations should be changed, certainly the boards could consider changes in the future and go through a very, you know, considerate and deliberative process again to make those changes. But we did not want to hold up collaborative practice any longer. So that is our recommendation, and we'd like to have a motion made to accept the draft regulations as last published, and that they would become final and published in the DC Register as such. Are there any questions from the board or any other questions from the public regarding collaborative practice?
Any questions? No? Board members, so are we ready to make a motion, or can we entertain a motion to approve this draft as final of the collaborative practice regulation so that it can go back into the register?
Just a clarification. So the recommendation would be that, so then we would need to pass along that recommendation to the Board of Medicine, correct? Okay, and then we would get their acknowledgement that they agree, and then we could, so they would vote on that in their meeting, and then assuming we both agreed, then we can move forward with publishing as final, correct? Okay, great, thanks. What?
So moved.
So moved.
You're second?
Second.
Thank you. Is there general consensus in favor of the motion? Yes?
Yes.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? The motion carries. So now that will go to the Board of Medicine. Fingers crossed that they are okay with the current language so that it can move forward. Finally.
If they're not, they will be the ones to, yes, to write whatever changes and explain.
Absolutely. All right. Anything else?
That is our committee report. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That is quite a monumental feat, so we're pleased with that. So the next item on the agenda is the Communications Subcommittee report. And I am pleased to tell you that if you go to NABP's website, then you will see our January 2018 newsletter that has been published. The two areas that we kind of highlighted were the DEA Drug Take Back Day that we had, as well as we focused a little bit on diabetes in the District of Columbia. There's some other information in there from NABP that talks about things like, you know, the opioid addiction and naloxone and being careful to not keep opioids away from people who really do need them for, you know, for the appropriate purpose. But please feel free to check that out. Once again, let us know if there's anything that you guys think you could benefit from being featured in the newsletter. We would happily entertain those ideas. I did notice an article that was, I think, pretty interesting, especially because, you know, I always think about this, the pharmacy students and residents that we tend to have come to the meetings. And the UIC study that looked at the pharmacy workforce is published. It's available on a site. The link is in that newsletter. And just for the sake of knowing, right now, that when you look across this country and you look at the number of pharmacies per capita, there are some counties that have a lot of pharmacies and there are some that have zero. And so the reason that's important is, as we look at, you know, potential areas for jobs, with all these pharmacy schools and all these wonderful graduates that are entering the workforce every year, the places with the highest numbers of pharmacies per capita are in the Northeast, Southeast, Northern Appalachia, and the Plains states. And it's interesting because I know some years ago, it seems like a lot of our new graduates are moving over to like Texas and so on and so forth. It looks like you're probably more likely to find a job if you do move out there, because remember, there's a catch-22. When there's saturation in an area, then you might find a job because there are more pharmacies, but you might not because there's more, you know, it's more demand, it's a tighter market. But the point is, check out that survey. I think it's kind of interesting. If you look at that map and you see where all the pharmacies are saturated, they're all right over here on the East Coast compared to way over there. But then there's a lot more stretch out there on the West Coast too. So anyway, interesting article. Check it out, especially if you're interested. We are currently compiling information for our next newsletter. So again, any thoughts, any ideas that you have, then please share them and we'd be happy to consider them for publication. But just go to NABP's website, or if you Google, just put in NABP State Newsletter and you'll see DC's there. Any questions? And I can't thank the members of our communications subcommittee enough for work that they put into making sure that we're getting this information out there and published. So Mr. Curry, Mr. Bellegarde, wonderful work colleagues. And then also Dr. White, because she always has some good ideas for articles that go in there as well. With the career and for pulling a lot of data.
Thank you.
So we look forward to the next edition. All right. So our next item on our agenda is our NABP News presentation. So Beanie Matthew is going to come up and give us a rundown of some highlights from the NABP News.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Beanie Matthew, and I am a pharmacy student at Howard University College of Pharmacy. So right now I'm on my regulatory affairs rotation with Dr. White, and this morning I have chosen five different articles from the NABP newsletter, and I will be summarizing the articles here. And thank you so much for being here. Study which was done and it tried to identify if there is a correlation between opioid epidemic and acute hepatitis C infection. So a study was done in the Central Appalachian States and they noticed that there was about a 45% increase in hepatitis C infection, and more than three quarters of the patient cases reported that injection drug use was a risk factor associated with it. And around the same time, there was an increase in substance use disorder as well. So the study further continued, and it was evaluated that acute hep C infections and opioid epidemic has a correlation. So the study was expanded nationally to identify if there is any association with opioid use and hepatitis C infection. So the study group obtained surveillance data from in the past 10 years, which was from 2004 to 2014. And they tried to identify the incidence rate of hepatitis C infection and the percentage of admissions associated with substance use disorder. And some of the results from the study indicate the following. About 12,953 cases of acute hep C infections were reported. And the incidence rate, which is the number of new cases among the population who are at risk, and it is 0.7 cases per 100,000 patients, and this was a 132% increase from back in 2004. And also the opioid use is significantly higher among persons aged from 12 to 39. And specifically in the District of Columbia, there is a 1,000% or higher increase in the use of heroin injection admissions. So this is a chronic condition, like an epidemic condition, which needs to be taken care of. And some of the strategies or recommendations the study proposed including certain service program, medication assisted treatment, and also providing linkage of care to acute hepatitis C patients and those who are at risk of injection drug use so that they can be provided accurate treatment. And moving on to the next article, this was again also a study which was conducted to identify various areas where community pharmacies can strengthen or support public health. And this was a study which was funded by National Association of Chain Drug Stores and John Hopkins Center for Health Security. And the study basically was conducted because they identified that pharmacists can play a significant role in providing patient care and minimizing the health gaps in the public health sector. And three of the major areas where the study focused was on opioid prices, antimicrobial resistance, and involving pharmacies during situations of community emergencies. And the study proposed the following recommendations, and I'm pretty sure some of the points were discussed during the meeting. One was to involve community pharmacies and health departments combat opioid epidemic which includes reviewing the state standing order for naloxone dispensing, and also reviewing the payment and legality and liability issues associated with naloxone dispensing. And the other was to introduce a collaborative practice agreements with the local physicians, so that the pharmacists can have an agreement to recommend any antibiotic changes, because antimicrobial resistance is a growing issue. And another recommendation was to exercise protocols with local responders and the pharmacies, so that during a situation of emergency, which we had like a few months ago, to set up a protocol so that pharmacies can legally execute their services during those situations. Moving on to the next article, this was FDA issued a public health advisory on a plant-based product called Pratum. And this is a plant which is grown primarily in the Asian countries, and this has a similar binding affinity to morphine. So people who are taking it has an increased risk of abuse or dependence or addiction. And FDA reports that several websites in the US is promoting this product, which can be used for the treatment of depression, substance use disorder, pain, and stuff like that. And so some states in the US have banned this product, but a lot of states have pending legislation on it. So that's why FDA issued a public advisory on this. And some of the measures that FDA has taken was to ban the products from entering from international facilities into the US, and another was detaining shipments from international mail facilities. Some of the seized shipments with carton containing products were claimed as the following. They were supplemented as the dietary supplements. It was marketed under the name Relax Grow and Kratom Therapy. So if you look at the bottle on the back, it doesn't specifically say Kratom. It goes by the biological name. So patients, people who are taking it may not recognize that this is the product that's containing it. So it is important that the pharmacists should be aware of this product. And if a patient comes to the pharmacy, they should educate them on it.
Can you just clarify the mechanism of action of Kratom? Because that was like there was a CNN big story on this back in November and December. So
I know it binds to the opioid receptors. So I believe.
So is it for like another alternative for addiction, mm-hmm. like compared to naloxone?
Yeah. And FDA specifically states that they haven't really studied the product, and since there is a use similar to that, so similar to like marijuana. Probably they'll be like conducting more studies to see how it can be applied, but as of right now, it is not a verified product.
Can I just ask one other question? Mm-hmm. Is it considered to be unsafe? Does it have the same adverse effects like mm-hmm. respiratory rate? Mm-hmm. Things like
yeah.
that?
Yeah. So it has an increased risk of withdrawal symptoms, the common side effects that we see with opioids, which are like respiratory depression.
Okay.
Going on to the next article, this was an FDA label update on opioid containing medications for children. So basically, the article specified the use of opioid medications for the treatment of cough and cold in children. Since its use doesn't justify the risk associated with opioid medication, FDA limited the use of prescriptions containing codeine and hydrocodone for the treatment of cough and cold medications in children younger than 18 years old. And also in addition to that, it requires the addition of box warning and the risk associated with abuse and misuse for opioid medication. And also if you want the healthcare professionals to expand the education to the parents so that they can be taught that basically cough and cold conditions are basically self-limiting, and if worse, like they can be treated with either dextromethorphan or benzonidine for the symptom relief. And the final article that I chose, it discusses about a new certification program for the pharmacy technicians. It is a new certification program which has been introduced by Pharmacy Technician Certification Board since the past 20 years, and it is a sterile compounding program which ensures that the certified pharmacy technicians are in amidst the compliance of USP 797 and 800. And also, it also makes sure that they are expert in the sterile compounding. And also, it requires continuing CE credits and annual recertification. And the program was launched in December 2017. And that concludes my presentation. And here's my references. If you have any questions, please let me know.
Thank you. Any questions?
One question.
Uh-huh.
It's on the first one that you did about the
opioid.
Uh-huh. And opioid. Was there any correlation you mentioned about any increase in HIV infection?
Increase also? In HIV infection? Mm-hmm. It did not specify that. The study was primarily focused on hepatitis C and opioid use. So they did a scatter plot data, and it showed a linear correlation between these two, which means that it's two associated with each other. But it doesn't specify anything about HIV. That's it.
One question.
Uh-huh.
So, as I understand them, for sterile compounding, technicians will be able to participate. Is it only if they become certified, or
certified.
Can they do it anyway, and this is just additional education?
Mm-hmm. It's a certification program, so it's only.
So some companies, if I understand correctly, some companies at some point might start requiring that, hey, if you want to be a technician and work at our sterile compounding facility, you have to be certified. And if that mandate is put in place, they have a certification avenue to take to get that. So it's an opportunity, kind of like board certification for pharmacists. It's a great added bonus if you do it, because at some point, depending on where you try to work, they might require it. That's how I interpret that.
I think that's really great, and I'm hoping that in the newsletter, because NABP shares news for a big percent of that newsletter, maybe that would be something they would want to highlight, because it could affect all jurisdictions, right?
And then when I think about it, typically the technicians are very involved in the sterile compounding,
exactly.
So for them to be properly trained is important.
Is that certification intended to be like a standalone certification or in addition to CPHT? Did they indicate that in the article?
I don't know. I'll look into that.
Okay.
Any more questions? I thought I saw this.
Yeah, hi. This is also about the Appalachia study that you had.
Uh-huh.
In some of the recommendations, you know, we talk about this issue of using, supplying the syringes exchange and that kind of thing. Was there anything specific about Philadelphia is considering now, again, what I'll call that the free zone, where they actually will supply the drugs and all of the, I guess, the, I want to call it paraphernalia, the reused items. Was there anything in that article about those kind of recommendations?
No, it was like a general recommendation that they put as a paragraph, like towards the end. It didn't specify anything of the states that was involved. If you want, I can forward you the article.
Other questions?
All right, thank you.
Well, thank you for a great presentation. All right, and as we get ready to reconvene, we have another board member who has joined us. And if you could just introduce yourself for the record.
Tamara McCants.
Thank you. I think, you know, one of the reasons we put on the agenda for us to present some of the highlights from the NABPE news is really so that our local pharmacists, pharmacy students, residents, technicians, you can kind of take a look at what's going on around the country and think about how does that relate to what we're doing here in D.C.? What are some opportunities that we can look at in doing here in D.C. based on what's going on across the country? And so that hepatitis C portion that was presented, which I certainly want to take another look at some of the data and maybe see what are some implications around that. Another thing I'd like for us to consider, you know, I wonder how many places are really taking an approach where when they have a person who's using opioid and they administer an opioid antagonist, what's next? What's next in terms of how we really are going to put a dent in opioid addiction? I haven't heard, and someone in the audience or at on the board, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't heard anyone really come out and report that they're seeing a significant decline in opioid usage or even overdoses at this point. What I continue to constantly hear is how the antidotes, the antagonists, are being used and used. But at some point, I think if we're really going to be responsible healthcare providers, we need to get to the heart of what's going on. So I don't know, but you know, I they say the future is in the youth. So I think about the students and the residents and all, and I just wonder, what's our next step? What do we really plan to do to really put a dent in opioid overdoses and usage here in this country, and for me, right here in D.C., you know, where we start with that here. So, great presentation. I think that was great, good information. Hopefully for the audience, it triggers some things for us to think about going forward. Okay. All right, so without further ado, we will go to the next item on the agenda. The next item really looks at more January NABPE news, and a lot of that would be repeating kind of what Dean already presented, so I don't want to bore you with just repeating all that stuff. And so we will now move to comments from the public. So at this time, if there's any information that you'd like to share with us, we would love to hear it. At this time, we just ask that you state your name and then provide your comment. So we're taking comments.
Hi, Jennifer Thomas with Del Mar Foundation. I have a couple of items that I would like to share. We are planning with the Department of Health, the DC Hospital Association, and Premier, which is working with the hospitals, to have a quality and safety conference. It will be May the 9th. It's at the Maritime Institute. The big hot button issues and topics are going to be opioids, crisis, the use issues, readmissions, and the association of opioids and the admissions and hospital utilization issues, some things in behavioral health perhaps. We're going to have a moderated panel. We've asked Dr. White, she's checking into her schedule, to be part of that panel. There will also be topics on antibiotic stewardship, which is a hot button issue. Readmissions is always big here in the district, and how this affects us across care settings, not only the acute care hospitals, but across care settings, nursing homes, home health, trying to get everybody, pharmacy, engaged in this. That's one item. One thing I just wanted to say, and to Dr. Bernard, about the question about the opioid use, we are seeing decreases in the prescription claims data for opioids, and that's probably because of all of the issue, you know, the controls that have been placed by PBMs and some of the state laws, including DC, that's considering the short prescription days of therapy. But some of the issues I think that you all should be aware of in the community at large is that we have this huge shortage right now of parenteral products in hospitals and acute care. I was at a hospital this week, and it's not just, you know, it's opioids, but it's, you know, it's different opioids at different times, and Dr. Miles can probably speak to this. But I think it's something that, I don't know if the boards across the country are even, you know, really so acutely aware of this. I'm getting reports, and I ask for, say, well, what's your top five? And they go, like, top five, top 100 drug shortages. That, I mean, it's really huge. If the parenteral solutions are not available to mix the drugs with, most of the premixes are really short. So I don't know if there's anything that we can do here, you know, from the community and the board to help support moving something forward through FDA or other, you know, since this is the board and to help the public health and the safety of patients, because it's, you know, it's a huge thing. It's antibiotics, it's opioids, it's just about every drug, and Dr. Miles can say, and including, I heard syringes are also now in short supply. So even just to mix and to provide therapy to patients, and probably we're not seeing it so much on the outpatient side, but on the inpatient side, it's a big deal.
And is that a DC area thing?
It's nationwide.
So what's the cause of this all these shortages?
So part of it, what I was reading yesterday was it Pfizer bought out Hospira? And Hospira has had problems over the last few years with some quality control, and so they're really backed up on being able to provide pain medications and syringes for certain C2 narcotics, and it is having national implications right now, and people are having to look at their supplies and figure out how they can reallocate resources appropriately, and it's getting worse and before it gets better. They don't think they'll be able to correct the situation until, I think, sometime in 2019.
So here's the thing that I'd just like for us to know. This is very interesting. Think about it. You have people who may be in need of pain medicine. There's this shortage. Isn't it likely that they may turn to treating themselves with some other things for pain? I mean, it's well known, if you look at the information, a lot of individuals that turn to heroin are individuals that were pain patients and either couldn't get their pain medicines or could get a easier relief or escape by using an illicit drug like heroin. So it's interesting that this is going on at the same time that we are saying we're committing to addressing the opioid crisis. Wow. It seems like we're talking out of both sides for our next year. Any comments from the public?
Dr. Bernard, just a comment about the parenteral solutions. That has been widespread nationwide because, unfortunately, 40% of the normal saline bags come from Puerto Rico. That's supplied to the United States. And so because of the Hurricane Maria, I think that one was. What I heard recently, and the FDA obviously has shortages on their radar. It's a constantly fluid situation. I was hearing yesterday about flu medications now, because it's been such a horrible flu season, but yet the FDA website does the same thing about it. So the FDA is heavily involved. I know other boards, I support Maryland as well, and this issue came up about the hospitals are extremely concerned because what can they do? But just letting you know that they are looking at it, but it's probably not soon enough for most people around the United States.
Interesting. One thing that maybe I should have brought to your attention from the NABP news was, this might be a little scary to some people, because of some of the shortages, Baxter is extending the shelf life on some of their IV solution bags, trying to make, have hospitals use them longer because of some of the shortage situation going on. Very interesting. So the impact of...
We've even had situations with some of these shortages where the FDA has granted approval to import from other countries, like with propofol in the past, we've done that. And it's a huge problem in the emergency department, especially. Many people receive opiates because they come in for acute pain type issues, and we've gotten to the point where the hospital has been nearly out of almost everything, and we haven't been completely out of everything at this point, but I think that it's very possible that could happen, and I'm not sure what we'll do when the time comes. You never know when you're going to get any in. We place orders regularly. Sometimes it comes, sometimes it doesn't. We'll order 30 boxes, you get two. It's a really challenging situation.
Okay,
so,
this is very concerning.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing that. Okay.
So we'll follow up, see if anything's been going on, and if we need to push information out to pharmacists or pharmacies, we will do that.
And then I have an off-the-wall kind of question, since I don't want to take up too much of our time, but I'm just I'm curious. You hear a lot going on about the flu, and unfortunately, there are lots of people who are dying from flu-related complications, and I guess my question is there anything going on in D.C. where we are, increasing awareness, or my question is there anything that we're doing to try to address this, or what can we really do other than maybe send out announcements reminding people that if you have a fever or whatever, go seek help, or I don't know, I'm just curious. Anything around the flu here in D.C.? Yes.
Well, and some of the stuff that's happening, at least from the department, and Delmarva has been working with kind of coordinating some things. There's been a major outreach, media campaign to get the word out, get the vaccine. be, you know, cover your cough, make sure you clean your hands, and don't, you know, if you're sick, don't go to work, don't go to school, whatever, those kind of things. That's been within what? TV, movie theaters, we've got posters in metro buses.
What about schools?
The schools.
We need you to stay at home.
Schools.
So I was going to pass this around, but I'm Kim Greenwood. I'm from upstairs in the immunization program. I'm a registered nurse, and like Jennifer said, we have a whole social media campaign to address it. Spread love, not the flu. Valentine's Day, February. But it started back in October, and it is a social media push, but it's on all the major metro, and you'll see it in the newspaper, the Express newspaper. So we have social media, all the D.C. theaters in Washington, D.C., they're showing the commercial and different blogs about. Now, with the whole, everything that's going on with the flu and concern, so, you know, with D.C., we've talked about before, the immunization registry is citywide, that's downstairs. So the school nurses have to report to us, like how you all do surveillance and epidemiology, the compliance rates of the children in the D.C. public schools and the charter schools, so that we can see who's missing and who's behind. So your second slide that talked about collaborative practices, and Tamara and I have been talking about this. So we've been collaborating with the different pharmacies. Walgreens and Safeway have been very helpful to help out with the flu. So if people have run out in their private doctor's offices, their pediatricians, or their internal medicine doctors, they've been nice enough to be able to go to the different chain and retail pharmacies to get their flu vaccine. So that's the campaign that's going on right now with flu, as well as I have passed others before, and if you all need more, with the Office of Alliance on Aging Research. It's a great teaching tool about all the vaccines, and it has a tear-off card. It's in English and in Spanish that they can use to, you know, track their record. This is more so for adults. Children, again, they have their registry, or when you go to the doctor, you get your printout on your immunization card. Did you have anything else? So it's a whole marketing, and we're doing the best that we can about the flu.
I want to also add that, like she mentioned, even HEPRA has gotten involved because they're taking it really seriously about the flu outbreak and even trying to prevent the flu outbreak. So the call that we had the other day was mobilizing the MRC to go out to the hard-to-reach homeless population in collaboration with Safeway and Unity to give meet people where they are to give them the flu vaccine. So I am proud to say that pharmacy is very involved in trying to make prevent even worse of an epidemic that it is right now.
Yes.
It's a question. So I'm a retail pharmacist, and our current standing order allows us to offer vaccines for people ages 12 and older. Has there been any kind of like maybe discussion, especially obviously with the flu being as widespread and rampant this season, or seems to be more detrimental to our pediatric patients, maybe bringing that age down to allow us to start our immunizing a little bit younger? Because the indications on the vaccines indicate, you know, as young as, you know, swing is making older. So I'm just kind of curious, it could be one way to maybe combat, maybe increase some of these situations we're seeing now.
I'm not aware. I'm asking on board council. No, as of right now, we're not aware of any conversations about lowering the age to administer it. Certainly something that I'm sure someone has thought of.
Yeah.
And maybe that's on the table right now.
I mean, we see people calling, you know, all the time, especially when the doctor's offices don't have the flu vaccine. I'm just saying, you know, obviously, we're the first line of health care for a lot of these patients, you know.
Well, I was just reminded, thank you, that recommendation that change would happen right here. So since it's a regulation, apparently the board is within our purview to kind of decide whether or not we want to propose bringing the age down. So that's certainly something that, like I said, I'm sure, you know, people are considering.
But as of today, though, a doctor can write a prescription and give you the authority as a pharmacist to give the injection for any age. So you just can't do it on a standing order, but you can get a prescription from any doctor to immunize anything to any age.
So, yeah, I think that's something that the board, we will certainly take that into consideration, especially with what's going on now. Any other comments? Yes.
I guess I had a hard time hearing the naloxone
training discussion. So from what I understood, the training was developed by the Department of Health, and they're about to release it, but there's a delay. What was the reason?
So it was developed by the Department of Health in collaboration with GW, and right. We had a great presentation put together that we collaborated with Kaiser, a practitioner at Kaiser, with some of the content. And apparently it was ready to be released, but they're just trying to hold back and see if there's a change that's in the pipeline from the DC government. And then if everything stays the same, then my understanding is it will go ahead and get released. Alan, you can kind of clarify any of that for me?
That's my understanding as well.
What's the proposed?
We don't know. We don't know.
You've just been asked to hold off on releasing this?
Yeah, we've been asked to hold off. So as soon as we can provide additional information, we will definitely provide that information.
Okay. And no timeline?
Not as yet, but we hope to hear something soon.
Okay. And then the training itself, is it a mandatory live training, or is it training that's going to be released to the public that can be done, online or... What is the training?
It will be released through the Center of Rational Prescribing, so it will be an online continuing education program. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Center of Rational Prescribing, but it is a online continuing education portal with free live CEs for District of Columbia healthcare practitioners.
And no charge.
It's free. But and assuming nothing changes, and we would be following the provision of current law, it would be required. So a pharmacist licensed in the district would have to take it in order to be able to dispense or to furnish. But we're just waiting for our final feedback on that. Yeah.
I appreciate
that's
the clarification.
Separate from a physician's order.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. That's separate from a physician's order. So a physician, of course, can write for naloxone, but this would just be for the pharmacist to do so independently.
Tell us the website one more time for the classes.
For the Center for Rational Prescribing, you could just Google DCRX. I'm not sure if it has one of those weird nodes, but if you Google the DC Center for Rational Prescribing, it should come right up. Or if you go to the Board of Pharmacy or Pharmaceutical Control Division's website, you can access it there. Or if you go to the Department of Health's website under Health Regulation Licensing and you click Continuing Education, it is a link for it there.
And I'll put a plug in for any pharmacists or those of you that are representing organizations that you might want to share with your pharmacists. As a pharmacist myself, for my last renewal period, I went in, I had not used that site before, and I took HIV training. And I was very impressed. It's a pretest, and then you take the training. It's recorded. I was impressed with the subject matter experts. It was clear. It was concise. And then you take the post-test. And then you get your CE, and you're done. And it was easy. It was seamless. And I will definitely, as a pharmacist, use that site again. So might want to take a look at it.
Yeah, it's a pretty long link to get there. Just Google DC Center for Rational Prescribing. Actually, it's a gwcehp.marnercommunity.com. Just Google it. Mm-hmm. Take it. Lots of free continuing education stuff there. Questions? Any other questions or comments from the public? No?
Yes. I have two things. Dr. Bernard, so I want to make sure I didn't miss on the NABP presentation, that was focused on sterile compounding for technicians, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So I was just reading the NABP e-news, and I noticed that in the last two editions, January 17th and 24th, they talk about PTCB now making recommendations to change the pharmacy technician certification, and it would be in effect 2020. I know that a couple years ago, they were looking to make major changes by 2020 that had a number of requirements in there, and they subsequently, last year, I think decided to do away with that because it was quite onerous. And I think there was a lot of concern that it would be ready in time. But in reading this, it seems to say that they're going to change the certification, and I'm not really sure exactly what it is, and I'm just wondering if anybody else has heard about that. And for your packet, I think it's on page 35.
So I don't know if we have various constituents in the audience. Is there anyone who's familiar with some of the details around PTCBs, the changes that they're proposing for the certification exam?
It says the changes include a new a pharmacy technician certification exam, content outline, and an updated education training requirement. Both changes are supported by PTCB's most recent job analysis, pharmacy technicians, conducted in 2016. And it says the new content will focus on scope of the exam, core knowledge, relevant practice settings. They have to sign an attestation. Beginning January 2020, primary path to eligibility for the CPHT candidates will be through completion of a PTCB recognized program. And I guess they're saying if you haven't gone through a recognized program, the alternative path would be work experience. So I just wasn't sure if anybody's heard about this. This is the first I'm reading about it.
I do know at prior NADP meetings and conversation, because the good thing is PTCB stays very much involved with NADP, both at the national and the district level. I know, you know, from several years ago, and it's been an ongoing conversation about expanding the training of the technicians, because the expectation, the support role that they play in the pharmacy has expanded. And so trying to kind of align those core areas that were identified with similar core areas that NABP does for the NAPLEX, that kind of thing. And so I know they've been talking about some changes for a while. Those things seem like they are somewhat aligned with what the pharmacists, the entry-level pharmacists, really kind of need to address and demonstrate their competency in as well. So I'm kind of not surprised with those core areas, but a deeper discussion in terms of where they are, how they came to that conclusion, I'm not aware of.
So we might want to just keep our eye on that, and for any of our interns who are doing NABP presentations, just to keep the board informed. I've heard that some states are moving towards requiring PTCB as the mechanism for certification and thereby registration. So it'd just be interesting to follow up. Second question, do we have an update on the upcoming September district meeting and plans for that?
Yeah, so the meeting date has been established, September 21st, 22nd, 23rd, I think those are the dates. We have our meeting location. Tejal, our District 2 Secretary, has sent the information to the boards, in the process of sending that information to all of the pharmacy schools as well. We will start to hold our regular meetings with the individuals that will be involved in the planning, likely this month in February. We've had it like a preliminary kind of planning meeting, because remember, this is a joint meeting. This is a AACP-NADP collaboration, and so Howard is the pharmacy school in D.C., and so we had an initial kind of planning meeting last week to kind of lay out especially how we will ensure that there's more involvement from the pharmacy schools so that that half doesn't go away. We, you know, we have our hotel block. The link is ready for people to register. The thing that we now will need to do is get board members, staff members to volunteer, and our members over at Howard at the university to volunteer for the various areas. Programming, like what CEs we want, do we want receptions, poster presentation or whatnot, entertainment, fundraising. So those kind of logistics, you know, we'll go ahead and plan around those. But we have somewhat of a time line that we put together, how many weeks out we need to have certain things done. And so probably not today, but in the very near future, maybe like next week, an email will be sent out to the board members getting you to identify what area you want to work on. There's plenty of areas that you can, well, not plenty, there's several areas that you can volunteer for depending on what your interest is. But we're in a pretty good position. Right now the main things are identifying what kind of CEs do we want, what kind of speakers do we want, You know, we have some preliminary speakers that we've kind of tossed around. We're in the nation's capital. We still have one pharmacist who's in Congress, Buddy Carter. We have APHA, ASHP. We have CMS, all these, you know, organizations that are right in our backyard. We certainly want to work closely with them. Thinking about trying to get Tom Minigan to be a speaker as well. And so right now, the programming piece and the fundraising piece, our target typically is to fundraise about $30,000. I have proposed that we up that number to around $40,000 because D.C. is a hotter destination compared to maybe some of the other areas. And so, yeah, that's where we are. The main things that we want to kind of focus on now are programming and fundraising.
Great. Thank you.
There was another thing. I just wanted to clarify for the audience. Right now in D.C., for the pharmacy technicians, their certification, it does not have to be PTCB, right? We will take a board-approved certification as well. Is that right? I just want to clarify.
Right. You can have PTCB, which is the pharmacy technician certification, or another program that's approved by the Board of Pharmacy.
Yeah, so I just wanted to make sure that the audience is aware of that. Yes.
And is there a list of approved, I guess programs that you can accept?
Yeah, sure. That's on our website. If you go on the online license search, you should be able to find them. But most of the major chains do have an in-house program. And then we do have a few outliers, such as Pharmacy Technician University.
Good question. Any other questions or comments? Is there anyone who did not get an opportunity to just introduce yourself, state your name for the record? Yes, thank you. I thought I saw someone walking with you.
Josh Bailey, the pharmacy manager at the community Walgreens Specialty.
Okay, thank you for joining us. All right, and so remember to please make sure to sign before you leave. And if there are no other items, we would like to take this time to extend a huge, huge thank you to two of our board members who it looks like this might be their last meeting. March meeting will be the last meeting, all right? But I don't want to take this opportunity to say thank you to Mr. Bellegarde and Mr. Curry for the wonderful service that you have provided to the board. I think I was gonna reach out to one or both of you about entertainment, especially for our upcoming meeting. But look, this is an open meeting, so hopefully you'll still come and join us.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, thank you. Again, March will be their last meeting with us, and you guys have to remember this is a volunteer thing. We all have other jobs and other things that kind of takes up our time, and so the service that you have provided is very much appreciated, and we thank you sincerely. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and so with that being said, if there's nothing else, we are going to adjourn our meeting, and then we'll take a very short break before we get ready to go into executive session. So our next meeting with the open session will be, might be in April. I think as of now, we plan to have you back here April 1st. It's April the 5th, actually. I know the date for sure. So if you can join us, please do so on April the 5th. And we need a motion for adjournment.
Madam Chair, I move that the board close the open public session portion of the meeting and move into closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2-575B for the following purposes: to discuss disciplinary matters pursuant to 2575B9, to seek the advice of counsel to the board, to preserve the attorney-client privilege, or to approve settlement agreements pursuant to 2575B4.
Okay, so we have a motion. Is there a second?
Exactly.
Is there general consensus in favor of the motion?
Yes.
Okay, and so we'll take a roll call vote. Okay, so Dr. McCants?
Yes.
All right, Mr. Curry?
Yes.
Mr. Bellegarde?
Yes.
Mr. Friedman?
Yes.
And Dr. Miles?
Yes.
All right. So the motion passes. This concludes the public open session of the meeting. The board will now move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2-575B. for the reasons set forth in the motion. Thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you next time.